So over a few Sunday evenings, we are in the book of Psalms, and we have come to the psalm that we read earlier on, Psalm 45. And if you have a Bible, then open it there, and it will be the object of our consideration this evening. And as we consider Psalm 45, I would like us to notice in it three things. And first of all, an event. Because the main part of the psalm then is dominated by an event. That event is a wedding, a royal wedding, in fact. Now, there are no names mentioned, nor any details of the kind that would enable us to specify a particular historical king who's in view here. But doubtless there was a specific king of Israel or Judah who was originally in view when the psalm was written. Presumably it was written in order to mark the occasion of a marriage, a king of Israel or Judah getting married. But it probably became subsequently a generic kind of royal wedding song that could be used in any time a king of Israel or Judah got married, not just used on the one occasion that the particular king was married. And it's very carefully written then, this song. We all know, don't we, that at weddings a huge amount of attention is usually given to matters of the venue and the music and the procession and the bride and groom's attire, especially, of course, the bride's attire. And it was no different in the ancient world. And this poem does touch on all of those matters, but interestingly, it doesn't give them priority. So you notice it focuses, first of all, on the groom, the king. And yes, it does eventually tell us about his perfumed robes in verse 8, and in the same verse, the ivory palaces where the wedding is being held, and again in that same verse, the music of stringed instruments that is being played. So it does give us those details, but not until it has first described his character. The fact that he's this warrior on behalf of truth and meekness and righteousness, verse 4. The fact that he conducts his rule in uprightness, verse 6. The fact that he loves righteousness and hates wickedness, verse 7. All of that comes first, before his robes and the venue and all that kind of stuff. The character of the groom is clearly more important than the clothes he's wearing and the venue he has chosen and the music he has arranged. But having noted then that in verse 9, at his right hand stands the queen, the focus then shifts, doesn't it, to her, to the bride. And again, the psalm does eventually tell us about her robes and how they're interwoven with gold, verse 13, and they're many coloured, verse 14. And in the same verse, it does tell us about the procession, these virgin companions, what we would call bridesmaids. And so again, it does give us those details, but not until it has first described a couple of her marital responsibilities. So her responsibility to be wholeheartedly committed to her husband, to loosen her former ties with her father's house, there in verse 10. And not only that, but her responsibility to be submissive to her husband, who is her lord, verse 11. Her head, her authority figure, all of that comes first. Clearly the bride's marital responsibilities are more important than her outfit and her retinue and all of that stuff. So I'm saying the psalm, it prioritizes substance over style. Yes, it does tell us about the stylistic features. It does tell us about the aesthetics and the music and these externalities. But the couple's characters and marital responsibilities are prioritized over the external splendor and razzmatazz of their big day. But the basic point here then is that the psalm's about an event. And that event then is this wedding, this royal wedding. So that's the first thing this evening, an event. But then secondly, notice an echo. An echo. Because in the way then that this royal wedding is described, it seems to echo an earlier royal wedding. Which am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about the very first wedding that we have in the Bible. In fact, the very first wedding that we have in history itself, the wedding of Adam and Eve. Let me show you what I mean. At the most basic level, the groom here, as we've already said, is a king. That's mentioned several times. He's referred to several times. This groom in Psalm 45 is referred to as the king. And of course that echoes that first wedding at the start of history, because the groom there is a king. We talked about that this morning, didn't we? And how Adam's God-given role, according to Genesis 1:26, was to exercise dominion, to rule, to be a kingly figure. And so that's why I referred just now to that first wedding as a royal wedding. Adam's marriage to Eve was a royal marriage because Adam was this kingly, ruling figure. Then again, this groom here in Psalm 45 is said to be blessed by God. Verse 2, God has blessed you forever. Now that's very much Genesis 1 and 2 language, isn't it? It echoes that first wedding we're specifically told in Genesis 1:28 of Adam and Eve, that first couple that God blessed them. Same language. And so that's another little echo that we have here in Psalm 45. Then again, this groom in Psalm 45, in a certain sense, is godlike. So that's the point then in verse 6, where he is addressed as God. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. And I think the point here then is that Israel's true king is, of course, God. And this Israelite king then, like any Israelite king, he doesn't replace God or rival God. Rather, he rules on earth on God's behalf. He's the agent of God's rule, if you like. He, the proximate human king, is a kind of miniature representation of the ultimate divine king. That's the point. As this king here is addressed as God. And again then, that echoes that first wedding, doesn't it? Because the groom there is also a miniature representation of God. We're specifically told, aren't we, in chapter 1, verse 27 of Genesis, that Adam was made in God's own image. Godlike. And so that's another echo that we have here in Psalm 45. Then again, that emphasis that I just touched on very briefly a moment ago of loosening ties with former family, former relations as you enter into marriage. We have it in verse 10 there. The bride being addressed in this way, forget your people and your father's house. We have it, of course, in verse 16, more briefly, in place of your fathers. This is speaking now to the king, to the groom, in place of your fathers shall be your sons. So there's this emphasis in Psalm 45 of the loosening of ties as the marriage is entered into. And that, of course, is another obvious echo, isn't it, of that first marriage. And the very famous language of Genesis 2:24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. Verses 10 and 16 here are, again, another echo of that. Then again, the reference we have here in Psalm 45 to the bride being led to her husband. There in verse 14, in many coloured robes, she is led to the king. So she's not taking the initiative. She's not kind of just by herself striding out to him. She's not instigating this. There's a certain passivity to her role. She's being led to her new husband. She's being presented to him. And again, does that not echo that first wedding at the beginning of Genesis and the way we are told there in Genesis 2 verse 22 that the rib the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. The bride being presented to the groom, in that case by God himself. Another echo. And then one final thing. Notice the way it's envisaged here in Psalm 45 that this marriage will produce further rulers who will, look at verse 16, be princes in all the earth. So this marriage between this king and his bride will produce further rulers who will be princes in all the earth. Again, does that not echo that first wedding? We're told in Genesis 1 verse 28 that God blessed Adam and Eve, as we've already seen, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and so on. In other words, the way that the earth, and that's the same language, by the way, as verse 16 of our psalm, the way that the earth is going to be subdued, is going to be ruled over, is through multiplication. That is through Adam and Eve's marriage producing further rulers who will be princes in all the earth. Another echo. So I hope you see then, just in that brief way, that the way this royal wedding is described, in various ways it echoes that earlier royal wedding. And we need to then pause and consider this approach that the psalmist is taking, and I suppose it all really raises a very similar question, doesn't it, to the question that Psalm 8 raises, as we considered this morning. I mean, what is the writer doing here? Why does he write like this? Why these echoes? Because surely, for all the literary elegance of this psalm, and it is a beautiful psalm, surely it seems rather hopelessly divorced from reality. I mean, think about it. Supposing that Psalm 45 had actually been written centuries earlier on the occasion of Adam and Eve's marriage. Supposing it was their wedding poem. It was written for that wedding, the one between Adam and Eve. Well, we would have to say, wouldn't we, in retrospect, that the psalm is rose-coloured in that case. It's naively optimistic. Because, of course, that marriage, the marriage between Adam and Eve, it didn't live up to this poem's hype. For a time it did. But only until the day came when Satan invaded the domestic bliss of that couple, Adam and Eve. and used their marriage as his means of ruining the entire creation. So I'm saying, even as a wedding poem for Adam and Eve, it's rose-coloured. And certainly then for some Israelite king and his bride several centuries later, it's rose-coloured, it's naively optimistic. I mean, as we've said, we don't know which particular Israelite king it was written for, which royal marriage it was written for, but we can say, can't we, with absolute certainty, that whichever royal marriage it was, that marriage failed to live up to the hype of Psalm 45. It failed to live up to the terms, these glowing terms of this wedding poem. Inevitably, whichever marriage it was written for, inevitably there would be a substantial gap between the poem and the reality of that marriage. Because the fact is, no marriage since that fateful day in Eden, no marriage has really replicated Adam and Eve's marriage before the fall. No royal marriage has. The best hasn't. And the author of Psalm 45 must have known that. So why then does he write like this? Why does he so idealize the marriage of some Israelite king? Why does he do that? Why in this poem does he apply to this royal marriage at some point in the history of Israel's monarchy, why does he apply to this royal marriage features of that perfect pre-sin, pre-curse marriage between Adam and Eve? I mean, isn't it just highlighting how far we've fallen from that rarefied atmosphere of Genesis 1 and 2? Isn't it just going to sadden everyone in Israel? The couple itself, the couple who are getting married, because they'll be very aware, we're not that couple, we can't live up to them. And the people of Israel generally, because they're going to be very aware, our king and queen who are getting married, then they don't live up to this king and queen in Psalm 45. And so why does he do that? Why does he write so unrealistically? Why does he write in a way that seems so divorced from the realities of post-fall, post-Eden life? Why this idealism, these echoes in Psalm 45? Well, that takes us to our third heading. We've seen an event, an echo, but then thirdly, an expectation. An expectation. Because it seems to me then that ultimately the answer to those questions is the same as our answer to similar questions regarding Psalm 8 this morning. And the answer is this, that like Psalm 8, Psalm 45 is prophetic. It's prophesying. It's forward looking. You see, for those with eyes to see it, it's embedded within the Old Testament scriptures an expectation that one day there really would be a marriage to celebrate. Embedded within the Old Testament scriptures, it seems to me, is that expectation that one day there will be a royal marriage, not merely on a par with, but actually in excess of Adam and Eve's original royal marriage. For instance, is that not why we have Genesis chapter 24 in our Bibles? Genesis chapter 24 is so strange. It's the account of Isaac and Rebekah's marriage, or not exactly their actual wedding, but how that marriage came about. And it's so strange because we don't know that much about Isaac, really, compared, say, to Abraham and Jacob. The account of Isaac's life is relatively brief and sketchy. And yet, Genesis 24 contains 67 verses. 67 verses about Isaac's bride being found and being brought to him. And you think, why? Why such a waste, it seems, of material that could be telling us so much more about Isaac's life? Why all that? Well, because one day there's going to be a great marriage. I think that's the ultimate reason. It's also why we have the Song of Solomon in our Bibles. A whole book focusing on this pair of lovers. Why? Do we really need that? Well, because one day there's going to be a great marriage. And I think Psalm 45 falls into the same category. And what is this great marriage then that one day is going to come about? Well, we know, don't we? As whole Bible people, as New Testament people, we know from various New Testament passages, I suppose most explicitly Ephesians chapter 5, we know what this marriage is. It's the marriage between Jesus Christ and his bride, the church, his own people, believers considered as this corporate entity, a bride, a woman, his beloved. And when then you see Psalm 45 as part of this trajectory, part of this thread that's moving from Eden to Revelation 19 and that announcement of the marriage of the Lamb, when you see that it's part of this Old Testament expectation of a great marriage to come, suddenly the psalm springs to life when we read it thinking of the bridegroom, Jesus, and his bride. Suddenly it springs to life in a new way, doesn't it? You could almost say that the psalm is a potted career of King Jesus, just kind of working through the great stages of his mission, if you like. So verses 2 to 5, there we have, if you like, his mission here on earth, climaxing in his victory, verse 5, which we know, of course, happened at Calvary. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. There will be much consideration in these coming days, particularly Friday, I suppose, much consideration of the death of Jesus Christ. But perhaps far too often it will be focused on simply as something in which he was rather passive, and we'll be encouraged to feel sorry for Jesus as this martyr, this victim. But of course, there are crucial New Testament texts which point to the crucified Jesus not as a victim, but as a victor. We'll be seeing soon in Hebrews 2, by death he destroyed him who held the power of death. Colossians 2:15, that then the cross, he made a public spectacle of his enemies, triumphing over them by the cross. 1 John 3:8, he destroyed the works of the devil. John 12:28, around there, the prince of this world cast out as Jesus is lifted up on the cross. There are these crucial New Testament texts which point to the cross as a mighty, invincible victory for Jesus Christ. And verse 5 then is an Old Testament foreshadowing of Jesus at the cross, crushing his enemy, Satan, the serpent's head being crushed, even as Jesus' own heel is crushed in the process. So verses 2 to 5 kind of point us to Christ's mission on earth. Then verse 6, his subsequent enthronement. Having died, of course, on Calvary, he rose from the dead, and then on the Mount of Olives he ascended into heaven and was enthroned, and that's what verse 6 is pointing ultimately towards. And of course now this address, your throne, O God, takes on a new meaning. That in the case of Jesus, he's not simply being addressed as God in some loose sense because he is a miniature representation of God's rule on earth, because he's a king. But as Hebrews 1 has shown us very recently, because he's the Son of God. He's the radiance of God's glory, the exact imprint of his nature. All the attributes of God are in him. He is eternal God himself. And verse 6 then points us to that moment where he takes his throne and takes the scepter of his kingdom. And of course, this very night, Jesus is enthroned there in heaven. But then verses 7 to 15 of the psalm, they take us forward to his marriage. And of course, there's a sense in terms of the chronology, there's a sense in which now we have this marital relationship with Jesus Christ. But perhaps in our modern terms, we could say more accurately, this is the time of engagement or betrothal. Because Revelation 19 does indicate the marriage itself comes at the end. And verse 7 to 15 then is ultimately pointing us to that, to this marriage at the end of history, when Jesus will be joined with his bride in a nearer, closer union than is now possible while we are on earth and he is in heaven. And there are little details that are picked up on in the New Testament. Verse 13, all glorious is the princess in her chamber. And in the Greek version of that verse there, it's that word for glory which we get so often in the New Testament, and so often in the New Testament applied to us on that last day. We're going to be glorified. We're going to be made glorious. And here then, the bride has been made glorious on that last day. As Ephesians 5 puts it, cleansed of every spot and wrinkle. Also, that touch in verse 7 of the groom, so joyful. He's been anointed with the oil of gladness. I think that's just pictorial language for he's joyful. He's ecstatic. He's full of rejoicing. We've talked in the past about Jesus' emotional life and about his joy, and how Hebrews 12 points, doesn't it, to Jesus. He went through the cross, he endured the cross for the joy that was set before him. And we said it's not the joy, he hasn't entered into it yet. Yes, he's been enthroned now, as we've already said, but he hasn't yet entered into his joy. The joy will come on the day of the wedding, the day of marriage, as finally he draws his people into his own bosom and enjoys such intimate union and communion with them. And what astonishing language, verse 11, the king desiring his bride's beauty. You'd have thought it'd be the other way around, as we were singing in that third hymn, us desiring his beauty, but here it's the king desiring our beauty. There's almost nothing you can say, is there, to comment on that, to explain that. It's just this bold, astonishing statement that we have there. And then verse 16 perhaps points ultimately beyond the marriage itself at the end of time to the age to come. In place of your father's shall be your sons. This is addressing the groom, addressing ultimately Christ. And I don't think we're supposed to ask, well, who are these sons in contrast to the wife, to the bride? I think the bride and the sons are the same. It's us, it's believers in both cases, just two different pictures for us believers. We're described as, we're in the psalm as the bride for most of it, but then we're in the psalm at the end as sons. And it says, you will make them princes in all the earth. That's language taken up in Revelation 5 that I quoted at the start of our service this evening. You are worthy to open the scrolls, to open the scroll. And you have made us priests and a kingdom to our God. And we will reign on the earth forever. And that language is alluding, it seems, to Psalm 45:16, "You will make them princes in all the earth." And it's talking about what we were talking about this morning, then, that in that endless age to come, we are going to actually share in Christ's rule over that new creation. We're going to be princes reigning in that new world. I think that's what verse 16 is ultimately pointing towards. And so, read in the light of our New Testaments, what riches suddenly come alive in Psalm 45. It's tracing the career of Jesus, his mission on earth, his enthronement, his marriage at the end of time, and then even beyond that, as he shares his rule over this new liberated creation, he shares his rule with all his people. Are you excited by this prospect this evening? The prospect of this marriage. This really is the ultimate reason, isn't it, that as evangelical Christians we're big on marriage. And we emphasize the importance and the goodness of marriage. It's not, of course, because it's God's will for all his people to be married. Of course, that's not the case at all. And it's not even ultimately simply that it's for the good of society, although of course marriage is for the good of society, and that's an important point. But there's a much higher reason why marriage is to be emphasized and celebrated, a much higher reason than for society's good. It's because it's pointing to the great climax of history itself. The omega point of history is a wedding between Jesus Christ and his people. And every marriage that takes place on earth is a little pointer to that. It's a miniature of that great wedding to come. Are you going to be part of that? Do you love Jesus Christ now? And are you looking forward, are you longing to that day, for that day when the union between him and us will be so much deeper and more intimate than it can be now, when the distance is rolled away and we're in his presence, we're right by his side, and unimaginable intimacy will mark the relationship between him and us for all eternity? If it's not on your radar, if you don't love Jesus Christ, come to him this evening. Perhaps you've been disappointed by relationships in this life, disappointed by those who have broken promises, who have let you down. This one won't. This perfect, perfect lover. Come to him. Amen.